With the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, and now in other parts of our country, we've been once again challenged to have a conversation, and maybe even more than a conversation, some change. To examine our relationships as people. So as in the past, now is a time or a cry for healing and reconciliation. In the December 2013 issue of State Magazine, they interviewed several ministers throughout the state. One of them was even David Smith, who was at this pulpit years ago. One of the gentlemen was Dr. Brooks Gardner, who is the rector of the St. Matthew's Church, Episcopal Church in Hillsboro. He wrote in an article that he has served a parish that dates back to 1752 and where they worship in a building that dates back to 1825. He goes on to write, like many churches in the South constructed before the Civil War, St. Matthew's has a balcony like we do, but that balcony was used for a different reason. It functioned as a slave gallery. It was intended then to draw a line in that building between white folk and black folk, and to say to those African Americans, you may come this far, but no further. Dr. Brooks shares the amazing story about the life of the Reverend Dr. Polly Murray. You see, she was a granddaughter of a slave who returned to the Chapel Hill area and her home area of Durham in the late 70s to preach. He goes on to tell the story how here she was at the altar, having become just a few weeks before that the very first black female priest in the Episcopal Church. But Dr. Murray had already compiled an impressive list of achievements. She was a civil rights attorney, co-founder of the National Organization for Women, a professor at Brandeis University in Massachusetts, a publisher, a writer, and a poet. Raised in Durham, this became for her a homecoming, a chance in a sense to write in her own life and the life of her community a new spiritual chapter. For she was well aware of the barriers that had been erected over the centuries, and she knew that those barriers don't come down easily or instantly. And we are witness to those barriers today. But Dr. Murray, preaching in Chapel Hill, says, and I quote, "It was my destiny to be the descendants of slave owners as well as slaves, to be of mixed ancestry, to be biologically and psychologically integrated in a world of separation of the races, which was upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States as the fundamental law of the Southland. My entire life's quest," she says, "has been for spiritual integration. And this quest has led me to Christ, in whom there is no east or west, no north or south, no black or white, no red or yellow, no Jew or Gentile, no Islam or Buddhist, no Baptist, Methodist, Episcopalian, Roman Catholic, no male or female. There is only one Christ, who is the spirit of love and reconciliation, the healer of deep psychic wounds, drawing us all closer together to that ultimate goal, a perfection that links us to God, our Creator, and to eternity with Him." End of quote. That happened in the 70s. You know what's happening in 2014. The dictionary defines reconciliation for us as the act of causing two people or groups to become friendly again after an argument or a disagreement. Coming together friendly after an argument or disagreement. What about a shooting? What about violence? Jesus spoke about this in his Sermon on the Mount, and we hear his words. Paul writes about it in the Corinthian correspondence and other places in his travels, preaching and writing for the need for the churches then and now, and for himself as Paul, for reconciliation. Which brings me to where we are. And what about us? And what about our community? What about the world in which we live? The Sermon on the Mount is full. It's full of theology. It's full of practicality. It's full of things that we need to know and to live about. And Jesus in this passage had been talking about the Ten Commandments and the law. And people then, especially the Pharisees, wanted to follow the law to the very nth degree. But here's Jesus. This man come from Galilee talking about the spirit and the heart of the commandments and not just following the law to the nth degree. We know of his disappointment, his disagreements, his constant back and forth with the Pharisees. But he's forcing them. But he's also forcing us to examine our inner thoughts, our desires, our motives. Jesus says, so when you're offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave that gift at the altar and go first. And do what? Be reconciled to your brother or sister and then offer your gift. Jesus, I think, is declaring that reconciliation takes precedence over even worship in the temple. A side note, Chuck Poole, who was a Parker lecturer, a writer, we have his books in the library, he believes and he writes, if we take this passage literally, it would make for some lengthy Sunday services. For you see, we would have to stop at the time of the offering. For each of us would have to go and seek reconciliation with anyone who has something against us before we could begin passing the offering plates. Should we practice that today? So maybe we shouldn't take it so literally as we approach our giving and our offering. But we do need to hear loud and clear that Jesus is talking to us about reconciliation with those we have wronged and with those who have wronged us. Is it a spouse? Is it a family member? Is it that person in the Sunday school class with us, a fellow worker? They don't have to be of a different color or race. They don't have to be economically different than us. Have we wronged them or have they wronged us? Now, Paul. Paul helps us, I think, to reflect on this text because, in a sense, This text stands at the heart and the mission of the church. And that means our church. 2 Corinthians, taken all the way from the 5th chapter of verse 14 to 6:2, is probably the greatest text in which Paul speaks of the new creation. And that new creation is the fact that Jesus has come and given forgiveness and died for our sins, and now we are supposed to be about this ministry of reconciliation. It is indeed one of the greatest passages in affirming what Christ means to Paul and his ministry. So here's Paul being now a Christian. Being Christian means that we have indeed been forgiven. Paul has been forgiven. We have been forgiven. But it also means that we stand in need of forgiveness on a regular basis. So the text recognizes above all our need to be reconciled to God, and it's an ongoing process of forgiveness and righteousness and love. Richard Hayes is the dean of Duke Divinity School and a professor of New Testament. He is a Pauline scholar. I want to share some of his thoughts with you concerning this Corinthian passage. He writes, and I quote, "The interesting thing about the word reconciliation in ordinary Greek usage is not a religious term. That is to say, it does not appear in cultic contexts where people speak and seek to appease God by coming and offering sacrifices. Nor does it have anything to do with the cleansing guilt or receiving divine pardon for sins. So that's not what it is. Rather," he says, "it is a word drawn from the sphere of politics. It refers to disputed resolution." So Hayes says, "So one could speak of the diplomatic reconciliation of warring nations, or in the sphere of personal relationships, the reconciliation of an estranged husband and wife." Paul, though some of you are studying him in your Sunday school lessons, often seems to be directing things to himself. I think he's not just saying, "Look at me and my sins have been forgiven, so I'm now a new creature." No, I think Paul is saying that the whole world, you and I, are being made new by the cross and the resurrection, and that all we are and all our relationships have to be re-evaluated in the light of the transformation of Christ in our lives. Hayes says what the Greek says literally is that God is placing in us reconciliation. Hayes says he suspects that this may mean more than entrusting a message to us. Something you read, we're supposed to take it to heart, and it's entrusted to us, and go forward. No, he thinks that Paul means that the word is implanted in us in such a way that we should come to embody the word of reconciliation. We just don't announce it. We embody it. And that reading is confirmed for us in the last part of chapter 5 when Paul concludes, "For our sake, God made the one who knew no sin to be sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." For our sake, God made the one who knew no sin be sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God. Notice that carefully. Paul says here, not so that we might know about the righteousness of God, not so that we might believe in the righteousness of God, not even that we might proclaim the righteousness of God, and not even so we might be justified by the righteousness of God. Instead, he says, so that we might become the righteousness of God. That is mighty humbling and powerful for our lives and our calling into the ministry of Christ. Thus, our commission from God is that we as a community, as individuals, are called to embody the righteousness of God in a world, to incarnate, if you will, in such a way that this message of reconciliation is made visible in our midst. It's like a glow about us and our church, and as we move about in the community, in a world, and people know without a doubt. Reconciliation made visible is something that can only appear in the practices that you and I can show in unity, in love, in mercy, in forgiveness, and in a self-giving grace that the world could not even dream of apart from Christ. It's all about God and Christ and you and me and what we can do and be about healing and loving our neighbor. Paul's concluding announcement. See, now is the well acceptable time. See, now is the day of salvation. So the ministry of reconciliation has begun, and we are caught up in it as callers of Christ. And that is extraordinarily good news, because it means that even in the midst of the present sufferings, we can trust that God's prevailing, reconciling power will always be there. It does not mean that there won't be protest. It does not mean that there'll be hurt in families and individuals. But it does mean that in the midst of whatever takes place, God is there. So I ask you, as I ask myself, what needs reconciling in your life? Where do we start? Who do I need to seek out? Who do you need to seek out? Can we be truthful with those we know and love? Is it worth the risk? Are we better off just leaving things the way they appear and are? You see, we know what the gospel lesson says, and we hear what Paul was about and what he did, but can I really practice reconciliation myself? Chuck Poole, again, in his books and in his writings and sermons, uses a term that he calls careful speech. He defines this by saying, speaking the truth about the pain we have caused others and the pain others have caused us, with no exaggeration of the other person's failure and no justification of our own, but nothing but the truth. So careful speech is not bringing all that baggage to that conversation and that healing time. It's not making it more than it was or is, but it's coming in truth. So whether one is attempting careful speech in Ferguson, Missouri, or to a parent, a spouse, a good friend, the practice is difficult and it's mighty risky. Lives could even be changed. Our lives can be changed. Because the risk involved with some reconciliation conversations, in essence, will never occur. There may be some of those in your life right now. For we know what needs to be said, but the pain and the risk of losing out on that relationship altogether seems to throw up to us a stop sign. No, don't go any further. And so for us, the conversation never takes place. You know, and I know, that when it comes to this practical spiritual discipline, it just may be the most difficult practice there is. It is often complicated, complex, difficult, and demanding. But the good news that we proclaim every day from this pulpit and in our community is that all things are possible through Christ. And that that relationship that needs reconciliation through prayer and through the work of God can happen in your life and mine. And thank God. Thank God it happens. Eric Lomax was born in Scotland. At the age of 19 years old, he joined the Royal Corps of Signals in 1939. He would become one of the thousand of soldiers, British soldiers, who surrendered to the Japanese in Singapore in 1942. Many of those were relocated to Thailand, and they were forced to build the Burma Railway, also known as the Death Railway, through the mountains, over the rivers. Eric Lomax would be tortured by the Japanese. Some 50 years later, he met one of his tormentors, and he writes about this in the book, The Railway Man. He says, if you're a victim of torture, you never totally recover. You may cope with the physical damage, but the psychological damage stays with you forever. A side note, when we are hurt by another person, we may be able to move on, but there's a great deal of psychological damage that may always be a part. Eric Lomax writes, at the end of the war, I would have been happy to murder him. The book was published in 1995 and became a bestseller. This past April, the movie version of The Railway Man was released. But back in 1945, Lomax, who returned to Edinburgh to live a life, became a life of uncertainty. Following 3.5 years of fear, being interrogated and tortured as a POW, he had no self-worth, no trust in people. He says he lived in a world of his own. For you see, the privacy of a tortured victim is more impregnable than any island fortress. People thought I was coping, but I was falling apart inside. I became impossible to live with. It was as if the sins my captors had sown in me were being harvested in my family. Another side note. Until reconciliation happens, it festers and builds and can cause pain beyond pain. Lomax goes on to write, I had an intense hatred for the Japanese. And I was always looking for the ways and means to do them down. In my mind, I thought of that hateful interrogator. I wanted to drown him, cage him, and beat him as he had done to me. In 1993, Mr. Lomax read an article about Mr. Negassi, who was his tormentor. Negassi wrote about the devastation guilt that he had over the treatment of one particular British soldier, and Eric Lomax realized that he was that soldier. In the movie version of the book, you certainly see how war leaves a mark. When Eric and his tormentor meet, one wonders what will bring healing to Eric's life finally. Will torturing his torturer bring satisfaction, or does he need to kill him in order to find peace? In their meeting, Eric encounters a man who is haunted by what he has done to Eric and to others. The concluding scenes show us loud and clear that neither revenge nor reconciliation is easy. Both revenge and reconciliation may bring some sense of closure, but they both come at a cost. Revenge is giving into one's anger and pain and lashing out at that person or group. But reconciliation is the act of giving up the pain and the anger that controls you. The closing scene shows the two men near where that railroad was built, encountering each other for the first time. The tormentor, in tears, embraces Eric and says to him, "So sorry, so sorry." And Eric, in his embrace, says to him, "I do not want to live that day anymore." And his tormentor says, "Neither do I." Sometimes the hating has to stop. Sometimes it has to stop. And Eric hands to his tormentor a letter saying that the war has been over for many years and we have both suffered much. But you, Mr. Negassi, have been brave in your work for reconciliation following the war. And Eric ends by saying, "I cannot forget, but I give you my total forgiveness." And with tears, the two who were enemies in war embrace, and in that moment become friends. That is an extreme illustration that happened in life. Maybe what needs to happen in our lives is not so extreme. Maybe it's just a simple sitting down with that person that we have hurt or has hurt us and begin the process of reconciliation and forgiveness and love. It's not easy. It is painful. It can be very complex. But God in our lives, working as he did through Paul, gives us an amazing grace and a will and a power to do what we never thought we could do. We know what needs to stop in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and other parts. But what needs to stop in your life? Where do you need to find reconciliation? The God of hope and the God of promise sent his Son that he might die for us and that our sins may be forgiven and that we may have life everlasting in and through him, and that we can carry on a life of reconciliation. May we go forth to abide in Christ.